We said in the previous session that the Four Noble Truths teachings, the first turning of the wheel of Dharma, form the basis of these first two philosophical schools of Vaibhashika and Sautrantika that we're looking at this weekend in this tenets text. And one of the main areas of tenets, not the only one, but one of the main areas, of course, is dealing with the Vipassana, the wisdom practice. And within this first turning of the wheel, when we talk about Vipassana practice or Vipassana practice in Sanskrit, then often it's presented in terms of what's called the four applications of mindfulness, that the basis of course, the wisdom practice is the concentration practice. And the concentration practice is samadhi practice, where we're developing shamatha or the jhanas, we are strengthening mindfulness, this mental factor of mindfulness. Then on that basis, when we enter into the vipassana practice, we then apply that mindfulness that we've cultivated in the samadhi practice. And often it's presented in this way, that we investigate four areas. First, we apply mindfulness by looking, observing, investigating the body. Then feelings. And of course, feelings here doesn't mean emotions. Feelings is talking about noticing pleasant, unpleasant, neutral sensations and feelings in the body and the mind. Then we can turn our attention to observing the mind itself and then observing phenomena in general. So then often in the Vipassana practice, we can investigate these four areas. And what we're doing in our Vipassana practice is investigating these four areas to come to develop or cultivate these three insights that we talked about earlier, the three marks of existence, that we come to realize impermanence. Suffering here, of course, means dukkha and no self. So in each of these four areas, we are cultivating these three insights. And in that Vipassana practice, we go through three stages. First, and I have the Tibetan words here because they're very short and brief, and I sort of like the Tibetan words. Go nyam tok. Go in Tibetan means intellectual. So the first stage of practice, of course, is to have a framework for practice, to have some intellectual understanding of the practice, of what we're trying to come to realize. And then on that basis, then to apply mindfulness to come to realize these three things. And so when we first investigate these four areas to come to realize, we start to have nyam. Nyam means taste or experience, that we come to experientially have a taste of impermanence, dukkha, and no self within those four areas. But that taste or experience, of course, is not very stable. So even though we may have some profound experience of impermanence, dukkha, and no self in meditation, then often afterwards it sort of wears off and we lose it. So we need to move to the next stage, which is called tok, or realization, where our experience is now much more stable. To go from this stage to this stage in our practice, of course, we need very good samadhi. We need the shamatha, we need the jhana. So that's why the shamatha or jhana practice is important. If we don't really develop that single-pointed concentration, then when we do this vipassana practice, at best, we can have some little taste or experience in meditation, and then it'll sort of wear off and we'll be back to normal. So if we really want to make sure that that experience goes deeper and it becomes more stable, then we really need to put effort into the shamatha, the concentration practice, the jhana practice. And then we can really have a realization of impermanence, dukkha, and no self, and that can be a very stable experience that stays with us. So what I'd like to do now, before we go back into our discussion, is again go into a meditation where we begin to go into this Vipassana practice at the sort of ground level. Ground level is we start with the body, and in terms of the insight, we really just focus on the first of the three insights. And so those of you who, of course, have done a Goenka Vipassana retreat know very well about this. Because in the Goenka Vipassana retreat, the focus is on the body. We're scanning the body, coming to notice sensations in the body to really primarily come to realize impermanence, that things within the body are constantly changing. So that's the emphasis of the Goenka Vipassana retreat, which is based on this sort of model here. So that's what we're going to do now. We're going to do a short meditation, focusing on the body and trying to come to at least some sort of taste or experience. And this is very important because, for example, impermanence, the fact that things are changing moment by moment, I think that's something that we all intellectually accept already. It's not something we have to think about to come to some conclusion. It's something that we know intellectually already because science has proven it, we learned it at school. None of us, I think, have any problem with accepting impermanence at the intellectual level. Whereas no self, maybe some of us don't have an intellectual understanding of that, and we may have to develop that to have that as a basis for practice. But, of course, if we leave things at this stage, if we develop very good intellectual understanding of impermanence, dukkha, and no self, and that's all we do, I think nothing much is going to change in our life. Because our behaviour is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behaviour is driven by our instinctive habits. And even though intellectually I think we all accept impermanence, our instinctive habits are opposite. Instinctively, when we interact with things, instinctively we see them as somewhat stable and static, that they're not really changing. And then often when they actually do change, we get frustrated and upset because we weren't expecting that, even though intellectually we know that's going to happen. So if we really want to improve our life, then we need to bring this intellectual understanding into experience, to realization. Then we'll notice improvement in our life. And so that's what we're going to start to do now, is focusing on the body and coming to bring our intellectual understanding of impermanence into experience. And then hopefully, slowly, that will start to have a positive impact in our life. So that's what we're going to do now. So those of you who've done a Goenka Vipassana retreat, then I'm just following the same practice that we do in that retreat. And those of you who haven't, I'll just guide through anyway. So let's do a meditation. As always, we begin by preparing the body. So keeping the back nice and straight. Allowing the entire body to become completely relaxed and completely at ease. If you notice any areas of tightness or tension in the body, then using the out-breath to relax and release that tightness or tension.
and allowing the breathing to settle into its natural rhythm. Not controlling or regulating the breath in any way. Preparing the mind, setting it into a state of ease and relaxation. Not dwelling in the past, not anticipating the future. Simply allowing the mind to come to rest in the present moment. Simply focusing on the sensations of the breath throughout the body. We can begin now our Vipassana practice, observing the reality of our own body. So bring your attention to the crown of your head, noticing any sensations in this area. Noticing with bare attention, observing the sensations directly without visualizing or imagining. And then move your attention slowly down to the area of your face, noticing any sensations in the face. And then moving your attention slowly around to the back of your head. Observing any sensations in this area. Moving slowly down to the neck, observing whatever is arising in this part of the body. And then moving slowly over to the left shoulder, observing any sensations. Moving slowly down to the left upper arm, the left elbow. The left forearm, and then slowly moving down to the left hand, right down to the tips of the fingers. And then moving back up to the right shoulder, observing any sensations in this area. Moving down to the left, the right upper arm. The right elbow. The right forearm, slowly moving down to the right hand, right down to the fingertips. And then moving your attention back up to the upper back area, the shoulder blades and the area between. Moving slowly down to the middle of the back. And then slowly moving down to the lower back area. And again, bringing your attention up to the upper chest area. Noticing any sensations there. Moving slowly down to the middle of the chest, the area of the diaphragm. Moving slowly down to the area of the stomach. Down to the abdomen. And then moving across to the area of the left hip. Moving down to the left thigh. The left knee, down to the left calf and shin. The left ankle, down to the left foot. Right down to the tips of the toes. Then moving back up to the right hip. Moving down to the right thigh. The right knee, the right calf and shin. Down to the right ankle. To the right foot. Right down to the tips of the toes. And we can slowly bring this meditation to a close. So that's one of the very foundational Vipassana practices, and of course any of you who have done a Goenka Vipassana practice know this very well. And just one point on that before we go back to our discussions is the Goenka Vipassana retreat is presented as a 10-day Vipassana retreat. But any of you who have done the 10-day Goenka Vipassana retreat know that that's technically not true. Because for the first 4 days, there's no Vipassana. In fact, all you're doing is focusing on the breath at the nostrils. So this is actually the shamatha practice, the concentration practice. Because as we said here, is if we don't have some concentration, we can do a lot of vipassana practice and not really get anywhere because our mind is distracted and dull. So therefore in this retreat, we spend 4 days only focusing for 10 hours a day at the nostrils to develop some stability, some clarity, so that then when we go into vipassana practice, hopefully we can have a little bit more taste or experience rather than just getting distracted. And so, again, in that practice, the Vipassana practice there, we're focusing on the body as we did this, the same way scanning the body. And primarily we are trying to come to have a taste or experience of impermanence. And those, again, if you've done that retreat,
know very well that probably the most common word that Goenkaji uses in the whole 10-day retreat is anicca, 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 i.e. impermanence. So he's really trying to get us to experientially see that for ourselves. So again, there's a big difference between experientially seeing that versus intellectually understanding it. And then often people have a resistance to the practice because they know it already. Why am I doing that? I know that. I know that everything in the body is changing moment by moment. Why do I need to meditate on that? The reason is, knowing it doesn't help, because our behavior is not driven by our intellectual understanding. Our behavior is driven by our instinctive habits. We need to change those habits. And our intellectual understanding is not going to change those habits. It's only through meditation, coming to directly experience this, that our instinctive habits start to change. So if we do this practice of scanning the body, looking at sensations experientially, hopefully with some stability and clarity, then that experience will start to change our instinctive habits. You'll find that more and more in daily life, you will be experientially seeing not only the body, but things you experience as changing moment by moment. And you will find, because of that, your craving and attachment for pleasant things and your aversion to unpleasant things will start to reduce. So this is why Vipassana practice is essential.
Okay. Let's go back to our discussions.
So we're sort of building the overview for the tenets text. So we said that the Buddha taught according to people's capacity, taught these three turnings of the wheel, the Four Noble Truths teachings, mainly in Sarnath. Those teachings form the basis of these two philosophical schools which we're looking at this weekend, the Vaibhashika philosophical school, which is the first one that really started to evolve after the time of the Buddha. And then also we have the Sautrantika philosophical system based on the Four Noble Truths, which really only started to really evolve quite much later, from the 4th century onwards. Also, in the Buddha's teachings, the second turning of the wheel is called without discrimination. And this was mainly taught in an area around Rajgir, very close to Bodh Gaya, where he achieved enlightenment. And here, in this turning of the wheel, the Buddha taught what's called the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras. And in the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, of course, the most famous of those is the Heart Sutra, a very brief sutra. In these teachings, the Buddha went on to say that not only is how we see ourselves as a person a problem, we overinflate a false sense of me, but how we see the world is a problem. That the world does not exist as it appears. That this is where this idea of emptiness now comes in. In Sanskrit, shunyata. So here, the Buddha said that things are empty of independent existence, that there appears to be an independent objective world there and an independent subjective me here, but there is no independent subjective me here, no independent objective world there, that everything's empty of existing from its own side, existing truly. So in the first two philosophical systems, they accept things exist truly, that things exist from their own side. But here, in this second turning of the wheel, the Buddha said that things do not exist in this way. Also, in the second turning of the wheel, he taught the idea of enlightenment, that not only can we achieve liberation from suffering, from samsara, achieve the goal of nirvana,
but we can also go on to achieve the further goal of enlightenment. So let's go back to the first chart, the first two vehicles chart. So we see here this vehicle is called Mahayana. So yana means vehicle, maha means great. So Mahayana is the vehicle that can take us to the great goal of enlightenment. And if we achieve the goal of enlightenment, we become Buddha, fully enlightened one. To develop the aspiration for enlightenment is bodhicitta. So bodhi is enlightenment, citta means mind. So bodhicitta is literally the mind of enlightenment. And the aspiration is that not only to strive for our own personal liberation from suffering, which is this renunciation, but on top of that, to understand that everyone else is stuck in the same situation, and to actually develop the aspiration of not only wishing to liberate myself from suffering, but wishing to help liberate everyone else from suffering, from samsara as well. Of course, to be able to effectively do that, we ourselves need to achieve full awakening. We need to achieve enlightenment. So that is this aspiration of bodhicitta, is the aspiration for enlightenment so that we can help to liberate everyone else from suffering as well. So if we develop that aspiration of bodhicitta, we become what's called a bodhisattva. So again, bodhi is enlightenment. Sattva here means courage or strength. So a bodhisattva is someone who has the courage or strength to strive for enlightenment to help liberate others. And here, the practices, what practices do we need to engage in to strive for the goal of enlightenment? Are normally listed as the six perfections here of generosity, ethics, patience, joyous effort, concentration, and wisdom. As with the Eightfold Path, then these six perfections can also be condensed into the same three core areas of practice of ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Because generosity, ethics, and patience can be subsumed as ethics. And then the fifth is concentration, the sixth is wisdom. And joyous effort is something we need to apply to all three. So also here in the Mahayana, we have the same three core areas of practice: ethics, concentration, and wisdom. And here, of course, again, the wisdom practice can be called Vipassana practice. And here, in the Mahayana, when we talk about Vipassana practice, as we see in the chart, we're mainly talking about this wisdom of emptiness. In Sanskrit, shunyata. This wisdom realizing nothing exists independently. Of course, we are also coming to realize impermanence, dukkha, and no self, because they actually act as a good basis for developing the wisdom of emptiness. So that wisdom of emptiness is a deeper level of Vipassana that we are coming to realize. And we are to achieve enlightenment, we develop the aspiration of bodhicitta, and together with that we come to realize emptiness, that there's no independent me, no independent objective world. So from this second turning of the wheel, called without discrimination, we have actually in the order, it's the fourth philosophical school evolved, called Majjhimika. And the history of that, we can look at, if we go back to that chart towards the end, the history of the four schools chart. We can see that the founder there of the Majjhimika, which is often translated into English as middle way school, The founder is Nagarjuna. And Nagarjuna lived around the 1st, 2nd century. And it was through a particular text he wrote called the Mula Majjhimika Karika, or the Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way, that this really was the basis for the Majjhimika philosophical system evolving. And then also within the Majjhimika, we see there are a number of sub-schools. Primarily, we see there's two sub-schools here, Svatantrika and Prasangika. The Svatantrika and Prasangika came about because this idea of emptiness that the Buddha taught in the Perfection of Wisdom teachings here in the second turning wheel, which then Nagarjuna explained in much more detail in his famous text, Mula Majjhimika Karika, is very subtle, very difficult to understand. So even within the great Indian masters that followed, there were different interpretations of what this idea of emptiness meant. And because of this difference, we have these two sub-schools evolving. That here we see Prasangika, the founder, is Buddha Palita. So Buddha Palita was a great Indian master in the 6th century. And he wrote a commentary on Nagarjuna's text, his understanding of Nagarjuna. But then slightly following him, also around the 6th century, we have another great Indian master, Bhava Viveka, who came along and looked at Buddha Palita's commentary and said, no, you didn't get it right. This is what Nagarjuna really meant about emptiness. So he came up with a slightly different idea. But then slightly after him in the 7th century, we have another great Indian master, Chandrakirti, who looked at both Bhava Viveka and Buddha Palita's commentary and said, actually, Buddha Palita got it right. You got it wrong, Bhava Viveka. So he's also what's called a Prasangika type person. So it was on the basis of these different commentaries that we have these two sub-schools of Svatantrika and Prasangika being formed. Actually, this sort of these two sub-schools, the names didn't really even come till much later. It was much later, and even it's suggested maybe even it was the Tibetans who coined these two terms for these two sub-schools. And also what we see within the Svatantrika, we have two further sub-schools within Svatantrika here, one called Sautrantika Svatantrika and the other one called Yogacara Svatantrika. And that is a little bit to do with the Yogacara Svatantrika. We haven't covered that yet. The Yogacara is sort of based on this third philosophical system, what's called the Chittamatra or mind-only system. So there was a great Indian master, Shantarakshita, here who followed a little bit the Chittamatra idea that there's no external reality at all. And so he then is considered to be the founder of this Yogacara Svatantrika. So there's another sub-school within that. But all of these details, of course, we're going to look at in much more detail next weekend when we go into the Majjhimika philosophical system. Is there any questions about that, the second turning of the wheel and then the Majjhimika philosophical system? So again, this is just a very brief introduction. Anything not clear? Right. So Shantarakshita, as we're going to see, particularly next weekend, he refutes true existence, external object. So that makes him a Majjhimika. On top of that, he has the idea that actually things are internal to the mind, whereas Chittamatra still accept true existence, whereas he doesn't. So that makes him a Majjhimika. But that's next weekend. Then we have the third turning of the wheel. This is often called fine discrimination.
And that was mainly taught in an area around Vaishali. And in the fine discrimination, the Buddha was also talking about the fact that things do not exist as they appear, but he gave a different slant on it, because when we hear this idea that things, that there is no independent world, no independent me, when we hear these sort of ideas, it's very easy to misinterpret that to mean, to think, oh, nothing really exists then. In fact, a number of modern day philosophers who look at Nagarjuna's work say exactly that. Some modern day philosophers look at Nagarjuna and say, you're a nihilist, Nagarjuna, because what you're saying about emptiness means nothing exists. So, and these are very smart people who are saying this. So it's very easy for us, when we look at this idea of emptiness, to come to this conclusion that nothing really exists and end up in an extreme of nihilism. And of course, if we end up in that extreme of nihilism, then we could think, well, if nothing really exists, nothing matters, I can do whatever I want. So that's not a very good place to be, stuck in that extreme. So the third turning of the wheel is to help people who, as a stepping stone to that. So in the third turning of the wheel, the Buddha is also saying there's no independent world, but he's saying that the mind, because everything's coming from the mind, he's saying the mind is something very real. So therefore, we can hold on to the mind as being truly existent and not fall to the extreme of nihilism. So even though there is no independent objective world out there, the mind, because the mind is the source of everything, the mind is something truly existent. So therefore, this idea, what he taught was that there is no independent world out there because everything is internal to the mind. There's no external mind world whatsoever. That everything's internal to the mind. Everything's of the nature of the mind. And so he taught here what's called the three natures, which we're going to look at next weekend. So, and also in this third turning wheel, he also talked about the idea of enlightenment, the idea of bodhicitta. So this also is belonging to the Mahayana vehicle. But here, then, emptiness doesn't mean nothing exists independently. Emptiness means there is no, the world is empty of being an external world. There's no external world, it's empty of that. I.e., there's no subject-object duality. That's what emptiness means. So these teachings then form the basis of the third philosophical school called Chittamatra. Chittamatra is often translated into English as mind only, meaning everything's the nature of the mind, that there is no external physical world, even though it appears to be like that. That's what emptiness means in this school. So what we see is that both the Vaibhashika Sautrantika are what's called Hinayana systems, or Hinayana tenets. And the Chittamatra and Majjhimika philosophical systems are Mahayana tenet systems, meaning they talk about the further goal of enlightenment. Whereas in these two tenet systems, the ultimate goal of the spiritual path is nirvana, is personal liberation. So this is how the four philosophical systems came from these three turnings of the wheel. Any questions about that before we break for lunch? We've still got 5 minutes. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Okay. So let's, to answer that, let's go back to the one of the first charts, the four Buddhist tenet systems chart, and hopefully we can clarify that. So we saw that the first two schools, the proponent here, someone who propounds these ideas, does accept truly existent external objects. So both in the Vaibhashika Sautrantika, they accept truly existent external objects, meaning things exist from their own side, they exist independently, they exist as they appear to us. Both the Chittamatra and the Majjhimika systems refute that. Both of them say there is no truly existent external world there, objective world there. But they come to different conclusions. So if we look at the Chittamatra, it says the proponent is a person propounding Mahayana tenets, meaning they accept that there is a further goal of enlightenment, who does not assert external objects, but does accept truly existent self-cognition. Whereas the Majjhimika, it says, is a person propounding Mahayana tenets who does not accept true existence even conventionally. So the difference is that they both refute that there is an objective, independent, objective world, truly existent world there. But they come to different conclusions. The Chittamatran saying there is no independent external world because the world is internal to the mind. There's no truly existing external world because it's internal to the mind. There is no physical world at all. It seems to be, but it's internal to the mind. So they still hold on to true existence, that the mind is something truly existent because everything is coming from that. Whereas the Majjhimikas also refute a truly existent external world, but they say that there is an external world that's not truly existent. So therefore, in the Majjhimika, both the external world and the person do not exist truly. Nothing exists truly. That everything is empty of true existence, is empty of independent existence, is empty of existing from its own side. Whereas the Chittamatrans are still holding on to true existence, that the mind is truly existent because everything is coming from the mind. Right. Yeah. Exactly. And exactly, that's the point. The Majjhimikas would agree with the Chittamatrans in refuting them, saying, yes, there is no truly existing external world. But the Majjhimikas would argue with the Chittamatrans and say, you need to apply the same investigation to the mind that you did to the external world. You only did half the job, that you didn't look at the mind. If you look at the mind, you also come to see that the mind is not truly existent. Right. And just a brief answer to your question is this last column, which we're going to look at in detail, the illustration of the person. What is the person? What can we point to as being the person, the essence of the person? And what we see is that all the schools, right up to what's called the Prasangika, they all point to something and say, that's the person. And most of them are sort of basically just pointing to the mental consciousness. So what I'm saying is that the Majjhimikas would say you can't point to anything, because if you point to something, it means it is existing from its own side, and we're not accepting that. Whereas all the lower schools do accept that you can find something if you search for it. The person.
person. Yeah, well, that's next weekend. That's next weekend. We're jumping ahead. So Chittamatta and Majjhimaka is next weekend. So, yeah, last question, then we'll break for lunch. Sure.
Personal liberation because they seek nirvana. Given that nirvana is no concept of Atman, there's no concept, how is that personal in any meaningful sense that you can relate to?
Right. Well, there's two parts to that question. I'll brief answer both because both of them will come up in detail starting this afternoon and tomorrow. Is remember, there's a difference between person and Atman, or self. So Atman and self is a false sense of person. So in all of these Buddhist philosophical systems, the Atman does not exist, never has existed, cannot exist. But because we believe it to exist, that's why we suffer. So we're coming to realize that there is no Atman. But that does not mean there's no person. So there is a person. There is a person in all these four philosophical systems. There's no Buddhist philosophical system that does not believe that there's a person. The person exists. It's how does the person exist is the question. And what all of these four philosophical systems are saying is that we are overinflating the sense of me or of person. And we need to strip away that false grasping onto self. So that's one point. But there's a second part to your question. And that is to do, also we're going to see in the philosophical tenets here, is to do with the idea of once we've achieved nirvana, what happens then? What happens then? And we're going to see certainly from the first two philosophical systems what their assertion is that once we have gone beyond samsara and achieved nirvana, then at the time when this body collapses, there's because we've overcome the cause of cycling in samsara, then when this body collapses and the body finishes at the end of that life, what happens? And there are different assertions as to what happens. And within the first two philosophical systems, the general assertion is that because we've eliminated the cause to be reborn again, there's no cause to have another body. And that actually that the body and mind that was created in that way, often the analogy that you see in these systems is that it goes out like a candle flame, gone. Then, of course, if that's the assertion, then there's no basis for person anymore because person is something that we label on the basis of a body and a mind. But these philosophical systems say that at the time of achieving nirvana and then this body finishes, the body and the mind finished. So for them, at that point onwards, you know, we can't talk about a person. Whereas the Chittamatra and the Majjhimaka philosophical systems, they would disagree with that. They would actually say that's illogical, what you're proposing there. That even though you, at the time of achieving liberation, and then at the end of that life this body finishes, then the body and the mind, particularly the mind, does not somehow vanish because there's this idea of continuity of consciousness. So the two other philosophical systems would say that at that point, you don't take a body and a mind within samsara, but there's still a person. So there is still a physical support and a mental support. So there's still a person following that at that time. So that's a difference of assertion in those philosophical systems. But prior to achieving that state, in all philosophical systems, there's a person. There's always a person. It's how does that person exist? That's what we're interested in. Okay? Lunchtime. So let's break for lunch and come back at 2:00.